listening to the Tennis.com podcast. And here's your host, Ed McGrogan.
Greetings, friends. The Tennis.com podcast with myself, Ed McGrogan, and Steve Tigner enters the month of December. We are mercifully, in my opinion, at the off-season, the pretty laughable off-season, but I know we've had this talk before, but we're here. I for one, will enjoy it and try to muster the anticipation for about matches that start about 4 weeks from now. I know that's kind of a rather dour look at everything, Steve, but you and I have had this talk before about really, I think tennis doing itself, its fans, its players, a disservice that, you know, what is this off season is really, you know, more or less just a short, brief break more than anything of substance. And I you know, when I'm on Twitter, I talk with people about this too. It does divide opinion, though. A lot of people do enjoy the pretty much 11-month schedule of the game. I think otherwise, but it's kind of an annual talking point.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think, you know, the players, from the player standpoint, they probably, you know, most of them would probably want to just play all year. This is what they do. This is how they make money. But from a standpoint of the sport and fans, I think it's better to have a break and more than a month. I mean, it used to be even less. It used to be 3 weeks. We've gotten it to a month. That feels like, you know, that feels like a big accomplishment in a way.
Yeah, and you know, it does segue into a point we were going to get to a little later in the podcast, but it makes sense now. You know, we see in December, this is exhibition time. There's over the past couple of years, there's been a few leagues, if you want to call it that, really kind of multi-week extended little gatherings of players. The most prominent would be the International Tennis Premier League, which takes place over in Asia. It was announced today that Novak Djokovic is passing on that and all the lucre that comes along with that. But, you know, I think there's no other way to look at that than a very smart and sensible decision considering all the matches he has played, and really just, I think, taking this time of year to do what makes the most sense. I know that these are not, you know, these events and these matches are not going to be five-set wars of attrition that we see at the Slams. And, you know, to the counter of that, most of the top players are playing in these events. But I feel like the travel that comes along with it and really just the time that could be used, simply put, even just to practice, if you want to be playing, I think players, you know, they miss out on that time with the schedules and the demands of the year. I think it's a smart call by Djokovic, and I can understand why players can't say no to the money that comes with this, but, you know, it goes back to the point I just made earlier.
Yeah, players and their agents can't say no to the money.
Right.
Agents get a bigger cut of the exhibition money than they do prize money. But I agree that Djokovic, you know, is doing the right thing. This season was a little longer for him. He started it a little earlier than usual in Doha, and he finished, you know, he's won the World Tour final last four years, but this was really the longest, you know, test for him. I feel like he needed and really wanted to finish out a great year the way it should be finished by winning all of the events at the end, and he did. And that he really felt like he was starting to waver a little in the first match that he played Federer in London, and then, you know, he really made sure that he closed out the season. But you also got a feeling he was really relieved to get it over. There was pressure right until the end, so I can see why he would just want to, you know, leave it behind for the moment.
Yeah, and it's important to remember that 2016 is going to be a busy year for everyone, at least, you know, when it comes to the upper tier of players and really the middle tier too, because it's an Olympic year. That falls always really right in the middle of the busiest time of year. It's going to fall in between the Canada and Cincinnati Masters events, and, you know, obviously you're coming off of the French Wimbledon run leading up to the U.S. Open. It's gonna be a very dense summer for tennis. You're gonna, you know, people who want tennis are gonna get a lot of it next year. And the, you know, the Olympics have been, have given us some really, you know, great matches over the time, over the years, of course, and that's just gonna add to what players have going on next year. You know, in a way that, that brings me to our original talking point, which was the Davis Cup, and obviously that's another international competition. Britain wins it in the final over Belgium, you know, not unexpectedly by a 3-1 score. And of course, it was a team event, but really almost more than most years, you could say that this boiled down to just one player, Andy Murray. And, you know, he goes 8-0 in singles over the year. He goes 11-0 combined with his doubles matches. And I think overall, it was a good, I think, way to really recognize, remember, acknowledge, you know, what a great year Murray had, because I think a lot of it was overshadowed by, of course, Djokovic, but also Federer's really renaissance, and also, you know, the really the questions of Nadal that dogged him all year. I think Murray's year really did get a little bit lost in the shuffle.
Yeah, you know, you sort of forget that he finished number two. Federer may have had the second best season, getting to the Wimbledon and Open finals and beating Murray, winning all his matches against Murray. But, you know, Murray finished number two outside of Federer and Djokovic. He was somewhere around 70-6. He didn't win any of the big ones he wanted. He couldn't beat Djokovic and Federer when it mattered. So to get this is it was deserved, and it sort of showed that, you know, he, you know, outside of those two guys, he really had, you know, he really had the next best year, and he also elevated himself to up with the other big guys in the big four by winning a Davis Cup. They all have one. All the top players of the Open era, virtually all of them have at least one Davis Cup, and now Murray's there, sort of cementing his place with those guys. He did it himself. You know, there's nobody has been more of a one man show in Davis Cup. The only guy to win 11 live matches in a season, he was only not a part. There was only one match that Great Britain won that he wasn't a part of.
Yeah, and I think this is a little bit, you know, the final in particular, a little bit emblematic of Murray's, you know, I think improvements across all surfaces too. This was held on clay. Murray, over the past few years, has really actually developed into one of the strongest clay court players in the game. He is an all court player by now. You know, I'm actually pretty bullish on where Murray goes from here. I just think that I think this was a very strong, positive year for him. Obviously, with the numbers, getting past you know, some injury problems of previous years. You know, the guy has beaten Novak Djokovic in Grand Slam finals before. It is hard sometimes to see, to kind of declare Murray as maybe a pick to win a match, but it, you know, a match of that significance, but he's done it before against you know, really the highest quality opponent you can have at this point. You know, overall, I do come away from this year and thinking ahead to next year, you know, pretty highly of Murray, and I would in a way be somewhat disappointed if he doesn't build on this in some way. But of course, you know, someone like Djokovic is really, he's going to have to play a part in that happening as well, and it depends on, you know, the competition.
Yeah, I think from a, you know, mental, psychological standpoint, there's a lot he can learn from the way he played in Davis Cup. Just that sort of sense of urgency to not let his emotions get the best of him, to use those emotions. If he could ever bring himself to do that when he's not playing for his country, it would make a huge difference. But I'm a little less optimistic for him. Not, you know, there's the Djokovic and Federer thing, which he knows and has said he needs to beat those guys. But also, I don't know if I would pick him in any big match against Rafa or Wawrinka. You know, he lost to both of them at the World Tour Final. That doesn't mean that it's always going to happen, but I think he struggles against those two guys too. He doesn't have a, you know, his record obviously is bad against Nadal, and I feel like Stan has almost, he hasn't passed him by in terms of consistency and his ranking, but when you put them head to head, I think a lot of people, you know, I think you would pick Stan, you know, probably more than 50% of the time. So you know, they're definitely up. You know, there's definitely great things for Murray, but there's other people who are also playing better.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those, you know, who would you have playing for your life type of deal. And I guess if you make that list, you can definitely make the case that Murray is still not, you know, the one you'd want to put everything on the line for. But, you actually hit on a good point there about, I was going to ask, you know, what did Murray do so well over this Davis Cup run to get this flawless record? You know, we've mentioned about what Davis Cup does to players, how play in this competition can vary from play during the tour schedule. And I think you hit on a pretty good point about really sort of the focus that Murray brought into these matches. I think, and I think you touched on this in your piece, that, you know, there was really no safety net for Britain overall if Murray didn't come through. I mean, Belgium was certainly capable of taking advantage of really any slip up that Murray had along the way here. And I think, you know, to kind of internalize that and to really have the urgency and the execution in the matches, you know, from singles to doubles all across the globe on a variety of surfaces. And I think once Murray, you know, really sort of understood that Britain had the opportunity to, and I think a pretty rare opportunity when you consider really their depth across, as compared to other teams. But it became apparent that they had a chance to win this entire competition, and really just very good credit to him for doing that.
I think the biggest difference was, like I said, was mental with him. Was each time you saw him get challenged or have struggle a little, he would be agitated the way he usually is, but it would never, but it always was, he always channeled that energy. Always, it was always used in a positive way in some way, even if he was ranting and raving in his usual way, it was, he would have a struggle for a moment and then he would play his best tennis. So he would respond. He used that emotion as a way to respond to a challenge. That's not always the way he is, obviously, on tour. He can really end up distracting himself and even exhausting himself and with those emotional outbursts. But, you know, if that's something, it's obviously easier said than done to transfer that over to your regular tour matches, but I think that was the big difference. He felt like I'm playing for somebody else. Like I can't throw these matches away on being, you know, getting angry. And that was the difference, I think.
Yeah. You know, of all these Davis Cup matches, not too many come to mind that, you know, I'm going to remember many, many years down the road. And we're going to be actually taking a look in the next 2 weeks over the best matches of the tennis year among both tours. You do an annual top 10 list, your gift to everyone each December, looking at the ATP, at the WTA from January to November, and seeing what, you know, what are the matches that we're going to take away from this year as the best, you know, the highest quality, the most significant, adjectives of that nature. But, you know, when you and I were just talking before this, going down the line, one thing that struck us was, and I think this is sort of a departure from previous years, is that this was really, I think, a better year for the women's game in terms of memorable contests, highest quality. You know, I think you can chalk a lot of that up to just how good Djokovic was in the men's tour. But I think this was a great year overall for the women's game.
Yeah, as far as matches, I mean, Serena, as dominant as she was record-wise, she played a lot of great matches. She played, you know, you have to put her down as playing a few of the best matches of the year, against Azarenka at Wimbledon, the big match against Vinci at the Open, that match against Tyler Watson at Wimbledon, Azarenka a couple other times in Madrid, and at the French Open. So yeah, you feel like, yeah, Djokovic, you know, there weren't many great, the big matches on the men's side, it was, you know, pretty much Djokovic won some good matches, but none of them, he didn't really let them become epics. But whereas Serena played a lot of, had to get herself out of a lot of really excellent matches. So you feel like the you know, the memorable moments were more on the women's side this year, which, as you know, in the past few years, it's been more on the men's side, I would think.
Yeah. And, you know, looking back, we look at really, even when Djokovic has been defeated this past year, those were, Federer accounted for half of those losses. They were all in straight sets. You have a, you know, Ivo Karlovic win way back when, in early January. And, you know, the Djokovic-Federer finals, which, you know, I think obviously had really the most buzz around them, they're both, you know, both of them were really neutralized by really just how good Djokovic was, and we did not see the Federer that we saw leading up to those matches, as dominant as he was in Wimbledon in the semis against Murray and at the Open against Wawrinka. We just didn't see that in those two matches. The men's match that I will certainly take away from this year was just so unexpected in how it turned out was, you know, the Nadal-Fanini match at the Open where Rafa, for the first time in his career, goes from two sets up, loses in a major, and two sets in a break, actually, and just, you know, that one as well, I think you just had the crowd element to it, which invariably in these lists, I think the atmosphere and the audience plays a part in really determining how, you know, how we remember a match.
Yeah, that was, you know, had to be the most memorable of the U.S. Open and maybe the most memorable men's match for, like you said, for Rafa's loss, and also just the level that Fognini got to. That was, you know, nobody had really seen him play like that before. And the and the scene at the moment, the night match at the U.S. Open, it really felt like you're reminded of what makes the U.S. Open special as an event. So yeah, that one's pretty much guaranteed to be on the list.
Yeah. And like I said, we will reveal those lists over the next 2 weeks, starting next Monday. I suppose if there are any matches, especially under the radar matches that would qualify and would would be of interest, you can tweet either of us and remind us of them. There's, you know, there are some good sort of ones that at first glance, you don't think of. Gasquet or Wawrinka at Wimbledon was a very strong, another great Wimbledon match. The semifinal between Radwanska and Muguruza, before the Serena Muguruza final there. There's quite a bit, you know, that there is to pore over, you know, from such a long time, so many matches really overall that. It has to be a challenge. You've done this for quite a few years, and it's, I think you probably always worry about forgetting one that's not on there.
Yeah, to reduce all the men's and women's to 10 and mix them together, it's not the easiest. You end up leaving behind a lot of great ones, a lot of ones maybe you thought belonged on the list, but you know, it's, I think it's fun to put them together, the men's and women's, not separate them, to, you know, sort of consider them side by side and rank them as one. I think that makes it interesting and sort of gives you a feel for how much there is in the sport of tennis over the course of a year.
Yes, absolutely. So we'll look forward to that, and we will bring back the podcast. Once we get going a little bit further on the off-season news and happenings, this is a time where we'll hear a little bit more. Coaching changes tend to take place this time of year. It gets ramped up pretty quickly, as you all know by now. So until then, this is Ed McGrogan for Steve Tigner on the Tennis.com podcast.
You've been enjoying the Tennis.com podcast. For all the latest news and events, head over to Tennis.com.